This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Good evening. This evening, our subject is Benjamin Franklin's Scientist. And I would like to begin by discussing briefly some of the distinctive features of the scientific attitude and the extent to which Franklin embodied those attitudes. So here are one or two or three of those hallmarks of the modern scientific attitude. Well, first, the notion that the universe is an orderly system. That indeed the very term universe etymologically is accurate, that it's got one set of rules that applies throughout the system. No exceptions. No mysteries. But in principle, everything within the system is explicable within the terms of the system itself. And that means no need for recourse to supernatural explanations. And I think that is, in fact, the most basic notion in the early modern attitude towards science. And let's put that in some historical perspective, because obviously that was a fairly new idea. To be sure, the Greeks had already the notion of law, of a law-like universe. They also had the notion of arbitrary gods interfering in that universe. But some of the great Greek philosophers had the notion of law. And yet, they also, and this includes the greatest of all the Greek scientists, Greek philosophers, Aristotle, they also thought that different parts of the universe obeyed different rules. So, for example, there's a difference between the heavens where motion is circular and there is no corruption, and in fact everything is perfection. A difference between the heavenly part of the universe and the earthly or sublunary sphere. In the sphere of the universe, which is below the level of the moon, in our earthly sphere, things move in erratic ways. There is corruption of matter. There is no perfection. There are two different spheres which obey different rules, different principles, and it's wrong to apply the principles that are valid for one sphere, that of the perfect heavens, to the sublunary sphere, the sphere beneath the level of the moon, this earthly sphere in which corruption, imperfection, erratic motion are basic principles. It was the achievement, let us say, of Galileo in the 16th century, in the period of the Renaissance, to challenge that notion. Now, one way he did it, of course, was very simple, by looking through a telescope and noticing that the moon and other planets have all sorts of irregularities. They're not perfect. The moon is, well, I suppose one could even see it with a naked eye. But even beyond the moon, there's erratic motion out there in the heavens, or at least apparently erratic motion. How do you explain that? In any case, already with the aid of the telescope, there was a challenge to the notion of two different levels of explanation. But much more important, of course, Galileo began to develop mathematical laws to explain motion in both the heavenly sphere and the earthly one, and he denied that there was any difference between the laws in the two spheres. And he proved it experimentally. No need for us to go into those experiments, but that's the basic notion. There's one set of principles, one set of laws of motion that's valid for the entire universe, including our earthly sphere, the world that's closest to us. Okay. So it seems that was one of the basic insights, the basic achievements of early modern science, starting with the great physicists, with Galileo. And of course, Newton came next, and Newton formulated the most powerful universal law. It's the law of gravitation. Franklin followed in the footsteps of those giants. If we think about his particular contribution to modern science, it was experimental proof that there is no essential difference between the kind of electricity that's generated when I move across this rug and rub the soles of my shoes on the rug, thus generating static electricity, and the kind of electricity which is involved on a much larger scale in lightning. They are the same. They obey the same principles. They are, in a sense, the same substance or fluid, if you prefer a different metaphor. That is what made him such a famous figure in the 18th century, that he was able to contribute to that notion of an orderly universe, a universe in which, in fact, the principles, the most basic principles of attraction and repulsion are universal. How important was that? Franklin became so famous in the 18th century. He was perhaps the equivalent of Einstein in the 20th, or Newton in the previous century. Here is John Adams, his colleague, who otherwise disliked him, talking about Franklin's reputation in France. His name was familiar to government and people, to kings, courtiers, nobility, clergy, and philosophers, as well as plebeians, to such a degree that there was scarcely a peasant or a citizen, a valet de chambre, a coachman or footman, a lady's chambermaid, or a scullion in a kitchen, who was not familiar with it, and who did not consider him as a friend to humankind. When they spoke of him, they seemed to think he was to restore the golden age. That is high praise from a man who disagreed with Franklin on virtually everything else. And in turn, Franklin regarded Adams as a lunatic. but in any case, that extraordinary fame, because he was the most important scientist of his day, and the French were, of course, amazed that the leading scientist should come from so backward a place as America. Okay, so if that's one of the hallmarks of modern science, Franklin was a perfect representative of it. The notion of a single set of rules requiring no supernatural intervention, nature itself as an orderly system, a rational system, and of course order and reason for the 18th century Enlightenment, the same thing. No arbitrary intervention by a supernatural power needed to explain any of the phenomena within that universe, and the laws of the universe operate universally. They are general. And if we look at the writings collected in Morgan's anthology, we notice that Franklin was in search of some universal fluid, and that he repeats this notion quite often in his writings, a universal fluid. Well, that sounds like Newton on the one hand. It sounds like Einstein on the other, because Einstein also believed God does not play dice with the universe and that the principles ought to operate without exception, without any arbitrary element throughout the system. Well, if that's one basic hallmark of modern science, let's take another one. The conventional wisdom is not to be trusted. The conventional wisdom about nature and about the universe, one ought to be skeptical about it. The attitude of the investigator is basically a skeptical one. Things that most people take for granted, or perhaps don't even think about at all, require the closest scrutiny and the application of a basic element of doubt or of skepticism. And if we associate the notion of universal laws with Galileo and with Newton, the great physicist, we associate the element of systematic doubt perhaps with a French philosopher. Of course, it's Descartes. The Cartesian method is the application of systematic doubt to all of our assumptions, all of our perceptions. And here again, Franklin is a wonderful example. He doesn't accept conventional notions. He wants to inquire further. Even things that people take for granted require the strictest skepticism. For example, people think that they know that a nor'easter, for those of you who come from the east, big storm, the damn thing ought to come from the northeast, but it doesn't. Franklin looked at the newspaper reports and compared the time when the storm hit in various places across the Atlantic seaboard and discovered that the nor'easter came from the south. Well, it might seem like a no big deal, but it's an example of that basic notion. You have to test every hypothesis with empirical evidence. And Franklin had that bred into his bones somehow. All right. let's take one last element. And this is perhaps less obvious, but if you think about it, it is part of the equipment of the really great scientist, and that's a characteristic that Edmund Morgan, in his wonderful short biography of Franklin, emphasizes on the very first page. It's just a basic curiosity about everything. And no doubt it's related to that other element of skepticism that we just mentioned. But a drive to know, to explore, to go further, to extend the boundaries of knowledge, to understand the way things really work, and to understand them everywhere, to be curious about everything. It wasn't just the lightning. It wasn't just the kite and the battery, which of course he invented. In other words, it wasn't just electricity. He made fundamental contributions to meteorology, medicine, engineering, navigation, absolutely. Another one?
Chemistry. He introduced Joseph Priestley to the experiments that eventually oxygen.
Chemistry, good, a good example. Priestley was one of the great figures in the history of 18th century scientists and a close friend of Franklin, just as Lavoisier was in France. And I think Lavoisier also shares credit for the discovery of oxygen. Is that right? With Priestley. Okay. Developed it? Yeah. Well, that's true too. A little footnote there. Lavoisier lost his head in the French Revolution, and Priestley, if he hadn't been lucky, would have been torn apart by a mob in 18th century London. So it could be a bit dangerous to be a scientist in the 18th century. But it's interesting that two of the greatest figures were among Franklin's closest friends. And by the way, another little footnote there, and that is one of the very worst characters in the history of the French Revolution, one of the most bloodthirsty, immortalized in a painting by Jacques-Louis David. Some of you may have seen Simon Schama's program the other night on PBS about Jacques-Louis David. That would be Jean-Paul Marat. Who was a journalist, as well as one of the fiercest figures in the French Revolution, a driving force in the terror. Marat was a failed scientist, frustrated because he did not get the recognition he thought he deserved, and who worked in the field of electricity, and who sought Franklin's friendship and recognition. Well, in any case, Marat was another victim of the revolution, but in a different sense. Franklin knew all of these people. And yet, interestingly, the work that he did pretty much independently. He was working on his own. He had some help, some of the electrical, the apparatus of the Leyden jar, for example, was something that he purchased. And he had a tremendous respect for equipment, for precision measurement, and for apparatuses, whatever, of various kinds, and was constantly having them made for him. We might even present that as a fourth distinctive hallmark of modern scientific thought. The emphasis on precise measurement and the mathematical basis of scientific law and scientific investigation. And here too, Franklin was right at the heart of things. When he was clerk of the Pennsylvania Assembly in the late 1740s or early 50s, his job, of course, was to take down the debates and the votes. Boring. He was extremely bored, and he occupied himself by doing mathematical puzzles, including this extraordinary thing called a magic square. I myself cannot describe it. In fact, I can barely add and subtract. But somehow, no matter which way you add up the numbers, they always come out to the same number, which was 2,056, no matter what row. And there were other constraints on the sequence of numbers. Who would come up with a thing like that? That is what he did in his spare time while the windbags in the assembly were making their orations. He was doodling, you might say, but in a typical way, he was doing it with numbers and exploring the properties of numbers. Enormous respect for mathematics, and especially for precision instruments, precision measurement. You put all of these things together, and you have the makings of a great scientist, which of course is exactly what he was. Okay.
Also, persistence goes in there, like his Gulfstream studies. That
right.
For a long time.
Right, a very good point. Persistence and the collection of data over a long period of time. Morgan reminds us that he made 7 or 8, or was it 9, cross-Atlantic voyages. Gathered data from others who'd made voyages and asked them to collect data of certain kinds. That kind of persistence is another one of his special qualities. And of course, he had a long time to do this kind of work. Remember that he retired at the age of 42, halfway through his life. And that period immediately following his retirement is the period of his greatest and most intensive contributions to scientific inquiry. The period of the 1740s and early 1750s, before he went back to London as an agent for Pennsylvania, and before he was embroiled in the sequence of controversies that led up to the American Revolution. That was the great period. And yet the obsession with science stayed with him for the rest of his life, so that, of course, he was still actively thinking in scientific terms when the French began balloon experiments in the period just before the French Revolution. What good is it, someone says? And Franklin's famous reply, what good is a newborn baby? The other side of the coin, however, Franklin always believed that serious theoretical investigation would and should produce practical benefits for humanity. And that, too, is a characteristic feature of the Enlightenment. It might not have been the greatest period in the history of scientific investigation, but it was the period when it was assumed that theoretical inquiry would pay off with practical improvements. And of course, Franklin was always busy tinkering with all sorts of things, from spectacles to stoves, in order to make practical improvements. And we remember one of his most basic assumptions: it's the little things that add up to produce major increases in the sum of human felicity, the sum of human happiness. And he was always looking for a practical payoff, even though he understood one doesn't always find it immediately. But of course, he was delighted, obviously, when the work on electricity produced an immediate benefit, the lightning rod. Okay, let's pick up that idea before we begin a discussion of some of the readings. Where do we find Franklin's most basic work? Well, Dave mentioned the Gulf Stream measurements of temperature. A particular interest of his, why does it take longer to get across the ocean in one direction than another? What's the importance of these differences in temperature, differences in ocean current? What's the relationship between these things? One of his major interests is navigation. And related to that, wind and weather. Wind and weather. I have a student who at this moment is in Waltham, Massachusetts, studying at Brandeis University. And I asked her, how do you like it there? And she said, I like Brandeis very much, but why doesn't anyone do something about the weather? Because having come from California, the very concept of humidity was utterly foreign to her. And the temperature is over 100 degrees, and the relative humidity is 100%. And she has been suffering. Franklin didn't know how to do anything about the weather either, but he was fascinated by it. Why? Because in an agrarian society, a basically agrarian society, weather determined the fate of the crops, the fate of the harvest, and therefore the fate of the economy. And so, of course, he was interested in what causes these phenomena. And he thought about it in completely secular terms. You might think if there is a drought, if you're still stuck in a pre-modern way of thinking, that you can pray for rain. In fact, the Prime Minister of Australia, where there is a drought at this very moment, has been urging Australians to pray. Well, who knows? It might do some good. But, sorry?
Can't hurt.
Can't hurt. No, can't hurt. A good rain dance never hurt either. But the basic scientific notion, you know, is that there are reasons for it. It's not an arbitrary punishment, evidence of divine displeasure. It's a function of changes in the surface temperature of the water. You don't need to go outside of the system in order to explain the phenomenon. So weather was one of his principal concerns. And if we ask about the lightning, well, undoubtedly, the main driving force was his interest in universal principles. If he could prove that lightning and static electricity were two aspects of the same phenomenon, well, that's the driving force of theoretical scientific inquiry in the 18th century. But, on the other hand, if he could convert that knowledge into protection against fire, well, that would be a major contribution to economic prosperity and security in the 18th century, with buildings made predominantly out of wood in America, unlike England in that period, which was already brick. Fire is a tremendous hazard, and of course he was interested in that. This is the man who started the fire department in Philadelphia, but here was something better. Prevent fires in the first place by developing the lightning rod. Let me give you one more example of how brilliant he could be. One of his great friends was a man named John Bartram. Bartram was an explorer and a botanist, the greatest botanist of the 18th century. And Franklin was interested in the specimens that Bartram collected, in the diversity that Bartram revealed. But he was also interested in something else. Franklin was also interested in something else that Bartram found, and that these were fossils. Bartram found new species of plants, but he also found evidence of things that no longer existed, or at least no longer existed in places where they were found. Here is Franklin's comment. It is remarkable that elephants now inhabit naturally only hot countries where there is no winter. And yet, these remains, he's talking about the remains of woolly mammoths, are found in a winter country. They found a great skeleton of a woolly mammoth in New York. It is no uncommon thing to find elephants' tusks in Siberia in great quantities when the rivers overflow and wash away the earth, though Siberia is still more a wintry country than that on the Ohio, which looks as if the earth had anciently been in another position and the climates differently placed from what they are at present. He drew the conclusion from his observation that fossils were appearing in places where one wouldn't expect to find them, that the climate had once been different in those places. And he is beginning, in fact, to anticipate the 19th century discoveries of the geologist Charles Lyell, which were so important for Darwin's theory of evolution. The notion that life on Earth has evolved and changed over a long period of time. And he did that from the evidence, from things that were otherwise odd or inexplicable, he drew conclusions that were counterintuitive. And he did so in such a way as to anticipate the scientific developments of the next century. Well, yes, sorry.
In one of his, one of the readings that we had, he also talked about continental drift.
Yes, incredible.
Yeah. 20th century.
Yeah, concept. Yeah. Yeah, there's one of the readings where it looks like he's talking about a liquid core of the planet and a shell that's moving over the surface. And yes, that is plate tectonics and the whole shebang. You know where that word comes from?
It's not the Big Bang.
Not the Big Bang. Shebang, I think, comes from the American Civil War during the Siege of Vicksburg, when the Union soldiers dug makeshift shelters into the rock along the Mississippi, and those were called shebangs because when they had some metal in them, I think when they were hit, make a noise, that shook the whole shebang. Well, in any case, there's a digression that seems to have come from absolutely nowhere. But Franklin clearly anticipated modern developments in geology. He really does fit the definition of a genius. So before we look at some of these readings, what are we dealing with here? We are dealing with a man, as we've said many times in our 2 or 3 weeks, who was the most important diplomat of the 18th century. He was the most important newspaper man, printer, publicist. He was one of the most important political figures. He was one of the great creative founders of civic institutions. He was all of those things, and if he were any one of those things, he would, of course, have a huge claim on our attention as a major figure in 18th century American history. But if you combine all of those things, or any of those things, with the fact that he was the greatest figure in science of his time, the most famous scientist, the most famous American scientist of the 18th century, the most respected, that's almost incredible that one man should achieve so much in so many fields. It's evidence of his extraordinary gifts, ambition, discipline, purpose, but also, I think, of a kind of, really a kind of genius. And it must have something to do with the way his mind ticked, with his, not just his particular kind of intelligence, but his drive to achieve, his drive to know, his insatiable curiosity. All of these things produce extraordinary achievements in a variety of fields. So we have one of the great polymaths, one of the great Renaissance men in modern history. Arguably, this is the first great American humorist, the ancestor of Mark Twain. So how do you get one man who, on the one hand, produces the line that issues in Mark Twain, and on another, the line that issues in Albert Einstein? Humor and science, they have nothing to do with each other. Maybe they do. But in any case, one man who does all of those incredible things. All right. Let's go to our readings. And we said last time that one passage worth looking at is on... Oh, I'm sorry. Before we do this, is there anyone who still lacks a syllabus? A syllabus for our class? Oh, good. Okay. Page 16 in Morgan. Wednesday, September 28th. This is the passage about the crabs. And why don't we read this together and talk about what qualities of mind, of intelligence, are evident in this particular entry in Franklin's journal. We had very variable winds and weather last night, accompanied with abundance of rain, and now the wind has come about westerly again, but we must bear it with patience. This afternoon we took up several branches of gulf weed, with which the sea is spread all over, from the western isles to the coast of America. But one of these branches had something peculiar in it. In common with the rest, it had a leaf about 3/4 of an inch long, indented like a saw, and a small yellow berry filled with nothing but wind, besides which it bore a fruit of the animal kind, very surprising to see. It was a small shellfish, like a heart, the stalk by which it proceeded from the branch being partly of a gristly kind. Upon this one branch of the weed, there were nearly 40 of these vegetable animals. The smallest of them near the end contained a substance somewhat like an oyster, but the larger were visibly animated, opening their shells every moment and thrusting out a set of unformed claws, not unlike those of a crab. But the inner part was still a kind of soft jelly. Observing the weed more narrowly, I spied a very small crab crawling among it, about as big as the head of a 10-penny nail, and of a yellowish color like the weed itself. This gave me some reason to think that he was a native of the branch, that he had not long since been in the same condition with the rest of those little embryos that appeared in the shells, this being the method of their generation, and that consequently all the rest of this odd kind of fruit might be crabs in due time. To strengthen my conjecture, I have resolved to keep the weed in salt water, renewing it every day till we come on shore, by this experiment, to see whether any more crabs will be produced or not in this manner. I remember that the last calm we had, we took notice of a large crab upon the surface of the sea, swimming from one branch of weed to another, which he seemed to prey upon. I likewise recollect that at Boston, in New England, I have often seen small crabs with a shell like a snail's upon their backs, crawling about in the salt water, and likewise at Portsmouth in England. It is likely nature has provided this hard shell to secure them, till their own proper shell has acquired a sufficient hardness, which once perfected, they quit their old habitation and venture abroad safe in their own strength. The various changes that silkworms, butterflies, and several other insects go through, make such alterations and metamorphoses not improbable. This day, the captain of the snow with one of his passengers came on board us, but the wind beginning to blow, they did not stay dinner, but returned to their own vessel. Okay. One little line there about humans, but it's mostly about crabs and seaweed. With this passage as our base, what makes Franklin so impressive? What strikes you about this particular example of his way of thinking?
His observation.
His observation, what kind of observation?
Details.
The details. What kind of details? Minute details that a non-scientist probably wouldn't think worth noting. Bill.
So he's got his eyes open. He's open to observation. I mean, not only the way he observes, but that he observes.
The very fact that he is open.
His mind is receptive.
Receptive, a very good term, perfect term, yes.
I think it's much more than that.
Yeah.
It goes immediately to design and experiment.
Right.
He has an idea, he observes something, he has an idea.
Right.
Now he's going to do an experiment and
okay.
See what happens to test that.
Okay.
That's the hardest.
He makes the observations, then there's a conjecture, then there's a test, the experiment. Floyd.
I considered ad nauseum every permutation and combination of the simple facts.
Yes. So the exhaustiveness, the completeness of his observations and his speculation. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Also his speculation that this is in some way related to what is already known about other species of wildlife.
Okay. Right. So it's not just crabs, but also other creatures that go through apparently certain metamorphoses. Perhaps there's a common pattern, a common principle. Yes.
And he was enjoying himself every minute of it.
Yes, he's enjoying himself every minute of it. And perhaps that's one of the crucial things. Not just the scientific method, but the sheer intellectual pleasure in the process of investigation, observation, measurement, testing of hypotheses, adding to the sum of human knowledge, intellectual pleasure. Yes.
Well, otherwise, he shouldn't have been bored during that trip for 60 days.
Right.
Like his company.
Right.
He couldn't converse with anybody.
Right.
Difficult to have a conversation of 1 hour.
Right. So it is an antidote to boredom. It's one of the most attractive things about him. He doesn't bore us because he refused perhaps to allow himself to be bored. Yes.
That in one of the other letters to Peter Collinson when he sees the cyclones,
his
comment was the rest of the company stood there looking after it. But my curiosity being stronger, and it kind of stood out, that's the story of his curiosity was stronger than anybody else's.
His curiosity stronger than anyone else's. No one else would bother to investigate further or to wonder what causes that phenomenon, that odd phenomenon. Is this the little spout, the wind spout? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Any other observations about this passage?
Yeah. Seems to have started with the idea that these little things he was observing were buds on the plant.
Yes, yes.
So he quickly disabused himself of that idea.
Right, right. So he's making a distinction between, ultimately between vegetable and animal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And at first he's not quite clear on that. Yeah. Well, all right. So there it is, Franklin as an observer of the natural world. Before we take a break and get some air, why not something about electricity. The letter to Peter Collinson, one of the letters to Peter Collinson, see if we can find this, the section on electric fire, to Peter Collinson, 1753, page 121 and following. I won't attempt to read any very large passage. It's much too long. But if you flip through that long passage, look, for example, on page 125. I conceive, then, that this globe of water and earth, with its plants, animals, and buildings, have diffused throughout their substance a quantity of the electric fluid, just as much as they contain, which I call the natural quantity. This natural quantity is not the same in all kinds of matter under the same dimensions, nor in the same kind of common matter in all circumstances, but a solid foot, for instance, of one kind of common matter may contain more of the electric fluid than a solid foot of some other kind of common matter, etc. If the more electric fluid be added to one of these bodies, it does not enter but spreads on the surface, forming an atmosphere, and then such body shows signs of electricity. He uses the term equilibrium in talking about the way electricity functions, the way lightning functions. If we put these observations together, what's interesting about his way of thinking about electricity? Here he's thinking in a different way, it seems, than he was in the passage about the crabs. What's remarkable about his writing on electricity? In what direction is his mind working? Yeah. Yes.
And the idea that the clouds would have one kind of charge, an excess of one kind of charge, and the earth would have an excess of the other kind, and when the difference got to be a certain amount, you would get a lightning strike.
A lightning strike, restoring the equilibrium, discharging. Right, right. And of course, yeah.
But I think it's amazing that he came up with this without having formal training.
Yeah, yeah. He's operating here at a fairly profound level of analysis and introduced a series of terms like positive, negative, charge, discharge that are still with us today.
Wasn't that developed in later, at the time the lights of Lesser were developed?
In Leiden.
Positive and negative.
Yeah, yeah. But I think he theorized on a deeper level. Yeah. Yeah.
As a fluid.
He thinks of it as a fluid, mm-hmm. Obeying.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Right.
We still use
right.
That.
Yeah, the notion of current. The flow of electrons. Of course, he doesn't have the concept of an electron yet, but he's getting close to it. But the notion of a flow and of an equilibrium, very, very profound insight. Barbara.
Yeah. It seems to me that when he talks about, I conceive then that the globe of earth and water and everything, that
yeah.
It's like a cosmology.
Yeah.
Very, in some ways, abstract, but overarching.
When he says, I conceive then that this globe of earth and water, with its plants, animals, building, has diffused throughout their substance a quantity of the electric fluid, it's a cosmology, the notion that the entire universe is shot through with these electric forces, charges, and differs not in kind. Well, perhaps it does differ in kind. Some kinds of substances are different from others, but in the sense that they, that different quantities operate within them. Some substances are conductors, some substances are insulators. Franklin had the distinction between those two. But ultimately, the difference in kind between insulator and conductor can be measured as a difference in quantity. And the notion that quantitative differences really, at a deeper level, suggest a more profound unity in spite of the superficial differences in substances, in kinds of substances. Everything involves quantities of the same substance or the same fluid, namely electricity. That's the key insight. Floyd.
I just wondered how many people understood or knew what he knew, that matter could neither be created nor destroyed, just transformed.
Or energy.
Yeah,
this principle of the conservation of energy, which I think is related to that notion of equilibrium, a very profound insight that energy is not destroyed. It may be discharged, but it's not destroyed. It simply flows from one part of the system to another. Very, very brilliant. Yeah.
He makes the amazing statement in that paragraph that you read that the electricity collects on the surface.
Yes.
And it's very hard to know how he came to that conclusion.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. But he.
And it's related. Static electricity, electrons collect on the surface, they are repelling each other.
Uh-huh.
And the surface represents the largest area
uh-huh.
of the whole body.
Right.
So in order to repel each other, they must collect on the surface.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea whether he went that far.
Yeah, I don't know either. But he does, if you just step back from it, it's incredible how close he is.
Yes.
Without having the concept of the electron to modern thinking about electricity. And he did it with careful observation, with experiment, and with these brilliant hunches, these brilliant conjectures, which he then sought to test. It is an exemplary instance of the scientific method in action. And again, remember, from the Puritan point of view of his immediate ancestors, a lightning strike was a punishment from an angry deity who had damned good reason to be angry at us sinful human beings. And this is a totally different way of thinking. The phenomenon of lightning obeys the same laws as other manifestations of electricity. And it's not a matter of supernatural anger, it is a matter of natural law. Just think about what a huge leap that is from the way of thinking of his parents, a manifestation of divine anger, to his own way of thinking, an instance of the operation of basic and simple and universal natural laws. And of course, there you have one other example of the transition from the Puritan universe of his parents, in which a divine God constantly intervenes and is usually angry at a sinful humanity, versus his own universe in which the forces of nature, properly understood, can not only yield insight into general principles, laws, an orderly universe, but also practical benefits that will increase the sum of human happiness, or at least diminish the sum of human misery. It's an astonishing trajectory for one person's life to move from that pre-modern universe of sin and punishment to the Enlightenment world of reason and progress, even if it's incremental progress that only gradually increases the sum of human happiness. The idea is that we can understand, and therefore we can exert control. How different from the religious worldview. In the religious worldview of the Puritans, we can't understand because ultimately God's purposes are unfathomable, and we cannot control because ultimately we are at the mercy of divine judgment and natural disaster, which are basically the same thing. It's a huge leap that Franklin made.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.